From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a reflection on gambling and loss. We talk with Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy, two brothers who are also college professors and writers. Their new memoir, Double Down, is about their two-year gambling spree, during which both their parents died, and the brothers gambled away their inheritance and then some, only to be charged with conspiracy to defraud the casino, charges which were eventually dropped. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the recently re-released early albums of the Meat Puppets. He says their full body of work shows them to be one of the great American bands of the 80s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy, are brothers, college professors, and writers. They became gamblers, too, in 1995, after casinos opened in Mississippi, where they live. By the end of the following year, they had lost both their parents and started gambling harder, losing lots of money. In the process of gambling away about $250,000, including their inheritance, they were charged with felony conspiracy to defraud the casino. The charges hung over them for nearly 3 years, until last summer when they were dismissed without a trial. Now the Barthelmys have collaborated on a memoir called Double Down, Reflections on Gambling and Loss. They teach at the University of Southern Mississippi, where Frederick directs the writing program. Their brother, the late Donald Barthelmy, was an acclaimed writer. Let's start with a reading from Double Down. Here's Frederick Barthelmy.
$100 is a lot of money. Think of it outside the casino, and it translates into lots of things, lots of goods and services, shirts, dinners, hamburgers, movie tickets, tire repairs, shots for the dogs or cats, computer software, sets of bed sheets. $100 is still a fair amount of money in this world, but in the casino, it was a single bill. In chips, it was one black, one. If you played quarters, four greens. Either way, the hundred looked damn small out there in the betting circle. It looked weak, as if it wanted some friends, some other chips to play with. It looked as if it didn't have a chance in hell of anything but a quick dance into the dealer's rack. When you had enough stacks of black, the idea was that each of them represented so much food, so much rent, so much car payment. That idea escaped, along with the rest of ordinary reality. This was true whether you had chips or bills. Many times we walked around the casino with $5, $8, or even $10,000 in $100 bills stuffed in our pockets. When we had the money in our hands, it wasn't $10,000, it was just playing time. Time at the table or in front of the slots. You don't care about it as you would at home. You don't feed and nurture it. When we had cash in our pockets, the temptation to dump it into a slot machine was strong. The slot machine rewarded you right away just for putting your money in. It made attractive binging noises as it counted the money into whatever unit you were playing, $1, $10, $25 units. With each punch of the button, you knew that you could win a fortune. We had seen it happen, maybe not 100 times, but plenty of times. And even after months of play and months of losses, even after years of losses, we still thought we might win. Rick once said we would walk out of the casino one morning and one of us would stick a 5 or a 10 into a machine and punch the button and win $100,000. That all the debits would be wiped out with a single sweep, a single roll, a single twirl of the reels. That was the way luck worked, he said. That was the way the world worked. Things would suddenly and inexplicably turn in our favor. A hurricane of money and love. When Rick's landlord told him she'd hit $25,000 on a slot, especially when that happened, it seemed that the same thing was bound to happen to one of us. Steve's wise old red-haired car mechanic said he had made $60,000 on the slots the year before. We kept the faith, and the money kept flying out of our pockets.
Frederick Barthelmy, thanks for reading that excerpt of Double Down. And I want to welcome you and Stephen Barthelmy to Fresh Air. What's it like for two writers, two university professors, who understand motivation and self-delusion? I mean, you create characters with that in your fiction, to then manage to gamble away $250,000. I mean, like,
well, you get,
yeah.
Understanding self-delusion doesn't cure you of it.
I guess.
Well, it makes it entirely possible for you to delude yourself at great length, and which we did.
Frederick, you'd written a novel about a gambler called Bob the Gambler. Did it make you even more aware of what you were doing when you were writing that?
No, I wrote the book after we had already started gambling, and we weren't necessarily in the thick of it. But you could see, I guess you couldn't see what was coming, but you could see that you know trouble was that way. And we were gambling. I started writing Bob the Gambler because gambling was an interesting thing to write about, the pressures, the threads that run through the imagination as you're gambling. The possibility of winning seems strong, and it's also extraordinarily seductive in a casino. So that's really what motivated me to write Bob the Gambler, and then it turned out to be me, something which I was not prepared for.
Gambling came to Mississippi in 1992. In Bob the Gambler, Rick, you described the Mississippi town where he gambles as the outlet mall version of Las Vegas. And right. in Double Down, you say that gaming interests want casino gambling to seem harmless, fun for the whole family. Would you describe the casinos that, that you gambled in Mississippi?
Yeah, we were playing mostly in the Grand Hotel and the Grand Casino in Gulfport. We also played at the Grand in Biloxi, the Casino Magic, and a few other casinos. They're very gaudy, sort of Disney-esque, you know, lots of sort of slathered with neon and that sort of thing. And inside it's, you know, real noisy because all the slot machines are going off at once, it seems. So as soon as you get into the place, you're in a sort of different world where there's a din. And it's just, you know, binging and plinging and banging, and people are, you know, running hither and thither, and it's quite an exciting sort of a setting to be in. It's a little, you know, seedy, if you don't mind seedy. It's quite pleasant.
What would you like about that world?
Well, it took us away from ourselves. You know, we live in a college town. We teach at the university, where everybody is very quiet and.
Mild.
Mild. That's exactly the word I was looking for, Steve. Mild. Well, it's a little dulled, you know. I mean, we've been teaching at the university for years and years, and this was a way to sort of be bad without hurting anybody, you know. I mean, most people take as their vice something like, you know, alcohol or drugs or, you know, new partners and so on. So in this way, we could just, all we lost was money, and the money wasn't even ours. It had been sort of dropped on us from above when our parents died.
Right, an inheritance. Well, you write in the book, you know, as college professors, we were automatically in an out of harm ways subculture. So was it exciting to put yourself at risk through the artificial environment of gambling?
Yes, very. It's quite extraordinary when you don't have a lot of money. I mean, when you're not used to having a lot of money. I suppose for somebody like Larry Flint, who I saw on television, lost $1 million one night and then won $2 million the next, it's not quite as much fun. But for us, you know, we never had very much money. I mean, we had a regular sort of middle-class amount of money. And so when you go to the casino and you bet $4,000 on a hand of blackjack, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, you feel quite extraordinary. You're shot through with adrenaline, and the cards seem to come out very slowly, and there's something quite magical and almost religious about it.
There's also a different relationship to money that you have when you're in the casino. And most of the time, most of your life, most of my life, money is pushing me around. And when I'm in the casino, I'm pushing money around. You know, and it eventually leaves, of course. But
eventually, it gets you.
No, it runs away.
Yeah. Nice.
If you're just joining us, my guests are writers and brothers, Frederick and Stephen Barthelme. They've written a new memoir called Double Down, Reflections on Gambling and Loss. What's the difference in how you were treated after you became regulars at the casinos and started playing for higher stakes?
They loved us. They actually loved us. They loved us a great deal. I didn't love Steve so much, but they loved me. Okay.
Yeah, they loved Rick a lot.
Well, you know, you get
everybody knows your name, and they say hello to you when you show up. Did you just get here? And
yeah, ask you how you're doing and how you did last time you were down, whether you're winning or losing.
Can I get you anything? And
right.
Do you need a marker? And
they always want to give you a marker. Here, take a marker. Here's $1,000. Here's $2,000.
Marker's a check.
Were you flattered by this kind of special treatment?
I'm afraid the answer to that is yes.
Rick was certainly flattered.
Yeah. I'm afraid the answer to that is, you know, I mean, you try not to be, of course. You try to think, well, oh, they're doing this. This is their business. This is the plan. But you can't help but be affected a little bit by it.
How about a little psychoanalysis? Would you compare your styles as gamblers and what you think that said about you as people and as brothers?
The book goes into this at some length. I mean, we really played in quite different ways. Steve is a careful gambler. He guards his money, bets carefully, strategizes, and so forth. I'm more of a what's called in the trade a lunger, which is that I play reasonably for a while and then I get bored and throw all the money in at once, basically saying, you know, either pay me now or let me go. And
generally, the psychological patterns operate on everybody. They just operate at different paces. In other words, most of what Rick does, I do 4, 5, 6 hours later.
Did you ever get into gambling quarrels about, you know, whether one of the brothers was gambling too much or not enough or whatever?
No. No, I don't recall that. Do you?
Do you want to ask that again, Terry?
No, I want an answer. I don't want to ask it again. I want to hear you answer it.
Well, yes. The answer, what happens is that when we went down together, your progress goes a different rate. And so it often happened that one of us, come 8 o'clock in the morning, would be ahead by a few $1,000s, and the other would be behind by $3,000 or $4,000. And so the one who's ahead is, of course, you know, it's morning and wants to go home.
Yeah. Oh well, sure.
And the one who's behind, you know, can't go home because he's behind, and in consequence, the one who's ahead ends up behind as well. More often than not.
You were asking whether there were quarrels about gambling too much and that sort of thing.
I always told him he was gambling.
There was not
too much.
Very much of that, although many times I would be standing across the table from Rick, drawing my hand across my throat, suggesting that maybe he not push that $4,000 out there this time.
I thought you were telling me to cut my throat.
Oh, well, you did that. That's about as far as the quarrels got. Gentle suggestions that maybe we're going a little too fast here.
There's always a sort of an effort on Steve's part to help me or my part to help Steve. If I remember, you know, one time when I was extremely angry and I'd lost something extraordinary and was throwing money on the table in great, you know, large sums, and, you know, he would come by and say, you know, come on, don't do that. You don't need to do that. And it didn't make any difference. I did it anyway. And same thing happened in reverse. I mean, of course, if you get up next to Steve and you say, you know, don't do that. He snarls at you so bad that you fall over and stuff.
You say that, you know, you'd read enough to know that you were both acting as enablers and codependents when it came to your gambling obsessions. So what's it like to, like, understand that, to know about it, to know the language about it, and still do it anyways?
Well, the language proves remarkably, you know, unsupple on the one hand and really not accomplishing what it promises. It made little difference to have jargon to apply to it.
No, I think we knowing that we were doing that didn't have any effect in terms of helping us to stop doing it. We only stopped doing it eventually when the legal troubles happened and we ran out of money, ran out of the inherited money.
We tend to operate at a very high level of self-consciousness anyway, so that the psychiatric terminology and so forth just was a fancier language for what happens every day.
Also, it's sort of like a joke. I mean, when we say to each other, you know, we're enabling each other, we're actually making fun of this language, this jargon, because it's sort of, you know, often that stuff is used, and you think by naming it, help it, or you solve it, or you resolve it, or you heal it, and I don't think that's the case at all. By naming it, you don't do any of that. You just name it. And so in the book, with, you know, that sort of thing is mentioned, and I mean, it's the same sort of thing as eventually we ended up calling ourselves the
Lyle and Eric.
Lyle and Eric, after the Menendez brothers.
My guests are Frederick and Stephen Barthelme. Their new memoir is called Double Down: Reflections on Gambling and Loss. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Frederick and Stephen Barthelme. They're brothers who are also both writers and teachers at the University of Southern Mississippi, where Frederick directs the writing program. Their new memoir, Double Down, is about their 2-year gambling streak, which coincided with the loss of their parents. Now, you started gambling much more seriously after your parents died within 16 months of each other. And as you say in the book, because you didn't have children, family always meant your parents. Did you feel lost when they died, even though you were already middle-aged when they passed?
Yes. We were sort of extremely close to both mother and father and to the family. And there's a sense in which when they left, the whole family just disintegrated. Don had died. My older brother Don had died a few years before. And there isn't any family, you know, to replace mother and father and the five children, and 11 Winding Drive where we used to live in Houston, and you know, the way things were. So when mother died, that was a horrifying thing for us, since she was really the glue that kept the family together. And then a little bit later, father died, and the whole thing was gone. And
so I don't know that I felt lost exactly, but there is a, you know, sort of powerful sense of purposelessness or pointlessness
right.
with the disintegration of the family, which I mean, I'm sure when anyone dies, their survivors feel this. But it was doubly potent because the family was such an important part of our lives.
We describe how your father charted stocks, kept elaborate calculations, devised obsessive budgets, worried compulsively over every arcane financial detail. And then he left each of you $150,000 when he died. It seems like what you did is exactly the opposite of what he did. If he was so careful with his financial planning, you took the money that he'd saved and kind of gambled it away in this kind of, you know, high-risk obsession that you developed. Was that in some ways like a comment on your father, do you think?
No, I couldn't say it was a comment. Father was fascinated with money and numbers and so forth. I don't know that he was, I mean, he wasn't really stingy or anything of that sort. Money held this terrible fascination for him, and you know, beat him up his whole adult life.
Less so us, I think. And when he left this money, you know, it may be that there was some, you know, reaction to the way he had treated money, but it's also the business about you know, where this money comes from and what it is, what it represents, and you know, what it's standing in place of. And for me, there was always something about, well, you know, you're gone. What do I want with this money? You know, and I've got enough money to, you know, pay my rent, to buy my peanut butter sandwiches, to keep clothes on my back. I don't need your money. And if I can't have you, I don't want the damn money. That sort of thing.
You think it's a rationalization or the way you really felt?
I think it's the way I really felt. It's also a rationalization, but I think it's the way you feel. I mean, we were exceedingly close to mother and father, and the money just didn't signify in the way that it ordinarily would. I mean, money we earned at the university had a different edge to it, had a different meaning for us. We certainly don't spend a lot of money, you know, going around to stores and buying things, that sort of stuff, except for computers. I buy a lot of computers. But it just didn't, you know, register that this was a lot of money and we needed to sort of take care of it and so forth. It was like on fire, mostly.
It probably really meant a lot to your father to know that he could pass on money to you. How do you think he would have felt knowing that you'd kind of gambled?
He would have laughed. I'll tell you what he would have done. He would have laughed. He would have sat there and said, "You did what?" And then he would have laughed.
Is that what you think too, Stephen?
I think probably he would have laughed at first. After that, he probably would have wept. But
well, we're presuming he's gone, so he has no use for the money. No, I think he would have thought that, you know, he often said things like, you know, once you give the money to somebody, it's their money, so they can do with it what they want, and he respected that, I think. And I mean, I think he would have thought we were damn fools, a favorite expression of his. But at the same time, he would have thought it was odd. There's the other point that's made in the book, which is that, you know, he would have been proud of us for never giving up, which is something he taught us at great length.
Your father is a really interesting character in the book. He was an architect and teacher, and he built the house that you grew up in. Why don't you describe the house and some of the ways it changed over the years?
He built in 1939 a very modernist house, sort of based on some of Corbusier's work and some of Mises' work. He built it out on sort of a grassland prairie outside southwest of Houston, what later became Post Oak Road and the Galleria in that area. It was a very sort of open plan house, high ceilings, and it was just chock full of 40s and modern furniture, Saarinen and Alto and that sort of thing.
The guys whose work you'd find in the furniture displays in museums.
Right, right. In fact, we still have some. Steve and I argue. Steve has a particular alto chair I've been trying to get back from him for about 4 years.
There were two of these alto chairs. In his youth, my brother, I don't know, what did you do? You...
I had it covered purple. I don't know why it was purple.
And then you burned the legs up or something. In any case, there's one of these chairs remaining, which is in somewhat in disrepair in my house at the moment. And Rick has been trying to get it from me for 15 years.
Yes, that's true.
So what was swell and what was ridiculous about this house to you as kids when you were growing up in it?
There was nothing ridiculous about it, I don't think. I mean, it was fabulous. It was it sort of set the tone for the way we lived. The whole family was this way, and the whole spirit of the
modernist architecture was a sort of religious crusade.
Exactly.
So it wasn't ridiculous, and it was devout.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to the way the family ran. It was very, the family was very literate, lots of reading and talking. These things were highly prized in the family. I think all of the sensibility, I've often said regarding Don, when asked questions about Don, that the sensibility really is derived straight from the family. I mean, mother and father were both, wicked with the language, wicked wits, and... could cut you down and put you back together. It's sort of like that classic samurai thing where the sword goes through you and nothing moves. That was the way they worked with the language.
Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy are the authors of Double Down, Reflections on Gambling and Loss. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of A Darker Place, a psychological suspense novel by author Laurie R. King. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, interrogations in casino back rooms. We continue our conversation with Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy. Also, rock historian Ed Ward on why the Meat Puppets are one of the great bands of the 80s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy are brothers, writers, and college professors who teach at the University of Southern Mississippi, where Frederick directs the writing program. Their new memoir, Double Down, is about the 2 years, 1995 and 96, when they were obsessed with gambling after casinos came to Mississippi. Their parents died during this period, and the brothers managed to gamble away their inheritance and then some, a total of about $250,000. As if this long losing streak wasn't bad enough, they were hit with a surprise, a frightening one. Let's get to the legal problems that you had with gambling. You were busted. Tell us You were busted on charges of conspiring to rig the blackjack game, yes?
That's right, yes. When we were busted, we didn't know that. We were just kicked out of the casino. Later, that was what we were charged with.
We were happily losing money one morning to the tune of about $10,000.
It's true. It's true.
Three guys who came to the table who, they were wearing suits.
They were wearing suits.
And broken noses and so forth.
It was all that hair on the arms that was the problem.
Anyway, the split lips and broken
noses. Came out under the cuff, you know.
Anyway, they came to the table and said, pick up your chips and come with us. And then they took us out into a little cinder block room in the side of the
garage. It was the way that one guy was scratching his side. That was what bothered me.
And interrogated us for half an hour and accused us of all manner of things. Suggested that we were having...
How do you say this on National Public Radio?
Affairs with the dealer, who we didn't even know, and told us we were 86. Do you know what that means, he says? And told us never to come back. And subsequently, we found out that charges had been filed, and it was about 8 months later that there was a grand jury indictment. We found out subsequently that the thing they say in the legal business is that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich if the district attorney asks it to.
Or a ham sandwich's friend, either
and
one.
We were the ham sandwich in this case.
You write it in your book, and I keep quoting your book because I think the writing's so good. You write, we were scared, probably more scared than necessary, because it was our business to imagine things thoroughly. What were some of the things you were imagining?
Well, we imagined picking up things by the side of the road in those striped pants as our future.
Dealing in cigarettes, selling cigarettes to others.
Making friends, making new friends.
Did you think you'd be spending a lot of time in prison and on the chain gang?
We didn't think that, but we did imagine it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's... In hindsight, it seems probably not so likely that that would have happened in any case. But while you're in it, when the pressure is on you, when they tell you they're indicting you, you begin to think all manner of things.
We had
to go to jail to be booked to the Harrison County Jail. And there's a whole chapter in the book about what it's like to be booked. I suppose a lot of people have been booked that, but we hadn't. And so getting booked was a big experience for us. And it's quite strange and terrifying. You're completely at the mercy of these other people. You cannot move until they say jump. And when they say jump, you say, of course.
After you both were indicted, the story of the charges against you hit page one of the New York Times. Now, what did that feel like as two writers who teach at the University of Southern Mississippi, and here you are on page one, indicted on gambling charges?
It was very annoying, principally because the report that the guy did, the New York Times gambling writer, who shall remain nameless, was rather seriously biased in favor of the casino, it seemed to us, that he had in fact stayed at the same casino, gotten most of his information apparently from the casino. And so the portrait of us was rather strongly leaning in the direction of guilt, whereas what we would have preferred and what actually happened with some of the AP reports when they rewrote the Times story, was a more balanced account, which said we were charged but did not say we were guilty, which is in fact or de facto what the New York Times piece said.
The Times piece was would say something, and then it would say according to court documents or people involved in the case.
People
and in
involved
fact,
in the case.
People involved in the case were the same people who had prepared the court documents, who were in fact the security staff of the casino.
Mm.
All right. That's where the information was coming from, although he didn't say that. It was according to court documents of people involved in the case. And then when the stories were reprinted in other local newspapers frequently, it would drop according to people involved in the case and replace that with according to the New York Times.
The evidence against you was videos that were made at the blackjack table. What did the casino see in those videos, and what did you see when you looked at the same videos?
The casino's all irregular behavior, which they then, on the dealer's part, really, she wasn't dealing strictly according to the book. the handbook for dealers, which was in the discovery materials, which we looked at all this material at great length. In any case, she wasn't dealing, you know, in a squeaky clean, perfectly straight, according to the handbook way. The trouble is there's a context, which is that no dealer deals that way after the first two or three weeks of their job. At least none of the ones I ever saw, except people who were trainees, followed every procedure to the letter.
The dealers are charged by the casino with making friends with the players, trying to get the players to come back. I mean, this is literally in their handbook. You know, make friends, be kind, know them by names, address them by name.
Guests like to be called by name.
Right.
Try to learn their names and use them, stuff like that.
In the process of doing that part, they sort of personalize their style of dealing, and the dealers do. And this particular dealer had a kind of very loose, casual way of dealing, which they saw as irregular and extrapolated from that there was something going on. What we eventually did by showing the videotape of the dealer dealing to other people was demonstrate that she dealt this way to everyone.
It was a long time before we got a full set of the videotapes, and as soon as we did, it was fairly easy to find on two tapes on 2 days when we were not there the same exact sort of things being done.
That they were talking about, that the casino or the gaming commission.
They were claiming were some big conspiracy.
Though it is true, also it has to be said, and that they had erased most of the dealers. They're supposed to keep it once they have a trouble with a dealer. They're apparently supposed to keep the tapes for 30 days of her dealing, or him dealing, and they had erased apparently most of those.
They supposedly had a week of tape of her dealing, and what I saw was
two hours
on one day and 2 hours on another of her dealing to other people. And when eventually those tapes got before the district attorney long enough for him to take a good look at them and check them with some expert that they hired or something, then they just dropped the charges. Of course, in the meantime, there was almost 2 years while we were sitting around thinking, you know,
but it was
about striped pants.
When the district attorney said in a public statement to the newspapers and so forth that, you know, there's no evidence of any impropriety on the Bartholomew's part, that was quite a relief from our vantage.
Yeah, and I don't know that he had to do that. I certainly appreciate it.
The judge dismissed the case last August on the request of the district attorney. Did it change your gambling habit? You know, once going through this whole thing of being indicted.
Yes, I think the pressure of being at law, I think weighed heavily. The fact that we'd already gone through most of the inheritance, all these things sort of, and also the distance from the parents' death, from in the sense that you've accommodated that information some years later. I think I've been twice this year, once to take a visiting writer down, and once I went back in March to meet some guy from the New York Times Magazine. But I've been twice this year, I think. Steve, have you been twice?
Oh, I may have been a half dozen times.
My guests are Frederick and Stephen Bartholomew. They're brothers, they're both writers, they both teach at the University of Southern Mississippi, and they co-authored a new memoir called Double Down, Reflections on Gambling and Loss. You both write, and your late brother, who was several years older than either of you, Donald Bartholomew, he was, you know, famous for his short stories, his experimental fiction. He became well-known before either of you were known. Did you feel like you were in his shadow at all when you started writing? And Frederick, I should start with you since you're the older of the two.
Yeah.
I think you're 4 years older than Stephen.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. In fact, it was very hard to figure out what to do as a younger writer when Don was doing what he was doing. We were both more or less trained by him in the sense that we studied with him, showed him manuscripts, worked over them with him. Eventually, I went to Hopkins to do a year with Jack Barth to learn something about suspense and plot and story, which Don didn't sort of specialize in. But even then... you know, having worked with Don so long, there was and having come from the same family, there was a similarity to the voice. And so whenever I would send work to the New Yorker or someplace, which was always, of course, the objective, sell it to the New Yorker, they would send it back and say it's too much like Don. And so it took a long time. Years later, I figured out something else to do. And so, yes, very much in his shadow, finally got out, I guess, in the early 80s when... you know, I started doing a different kind of work.
Describe the difference.
Well, I mean, his work was principally voice-oriented, surface-oriented. He was interested in language and the juxtaposition of imagery, juxtaposition of words. And I started being interested in story and in character and you know, people. And I, in fact, I remember this. I've told this before. I was driving over this long bridge. When you drive from Houston to Hattiesburg, you have to drive over this thing, which is called Bro Bridge. Yeah.
The Atchafalaya?
Atchafalaya Swamp. And it's like a 20-mile bridge. And then we were driving across it, my wife and I, and I sort of realized I was more interested in people than words, that people were more interesting than words. And that was, you know, I had just written a story called Shop Girls, which I had sent to The New Yorker, and later Veronica Gang, who was my editor there. She didn't take that story, but she wrote me a very nice letter that said, you know, this is an interesting story, send us more. I had previously been working with Roger Angel there, and who was Don's editor, and what happened was he was out doing his baseball reporting, and Veronica picked up the story, as she did with all of his mail, apparently, when he was out. And so that was the start of my sort of, quote, career. She got the story. She said it was interesting. She said to send more. I think they bought the next piece I sent them, which would have been Safeway, I believe.
Let me just ask you, what was it about the bridge that led to this realization that you were more interested in character and story than in words?
The bridge is a very gorgeous sort of...
bridge is quite a wonderful bridge.
...thing that you go across.
You should go there.
And it sort of puts you in a little bit of... It's 20 miles long, and you're, you know, up over this swamp, you know, 20, 30 feet over this swamp for 20 miles, and it's, you know, two lanes wide, and you're going 70 miles an hour.
All water and cypress stuff out there.
You know, it's like that the whole time, and so you can meditate during that period, and or you can reflect, which is what happened.
Will I have a revelation if I drive over it?
Yes.
Guaranteed.
Come, we'll drive over it together.
All of you pay the toll.
Stephen, did you feel like you were in two shadows when you started writing older brothers Donald and Frederick?
Not really. I've been writing and publishing in a desultory way for, you know, a long, long time, and Don was 16 years older than I am, so I was, you know, unavoidably in his shadow. I don't really feel so much in Rick's shadow. I don't know why. We were very close as children and have always been in and out of the writing business.
Mm-hmm. There's also the fact that
25 years.
That I cast no shadow.
Is that what it was?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure being here.
Yes, thank you.
Frederick and Stephen Barthelmy are the authors of Double Down, Reflections on Gambling and Loss. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on why the Meat Puppets are one of the great bands of the 80s. This is Fresh Air. The Meat Puppets weren't big sellers when they started out in the early 80s, but they proved to have a lasting influence. They encouraged bands to get out of the punk rock rut and into new forms of self-expression. Among their fans was Kurt Cobain. Now that the band's early albums are being re-released by Rykodisc, we can catch up with them. Our rock historian Ed Ward has the story.
We can hear the whole story. The Meat Puppets loom as one of the great American bands of the 80s. At a time when the pressures of radio play were forcing many of their contemporaries to narrow their vision, the Meat Puppets grew in a dozen different directions at once. There were three of them. brothers Kurt and Chris Kirkwood on guitar and bass, and drummer Derek Bostrom, all rich kids from Phoenix with serious bohemian tendencies. At first, they seemed just another hardcore band, but even on their 1981 debut album, it was obvious they were different.
Walking bus, walking bus, I don't.
Walking Boss is a folk song popularized by Doc Watson, who got it from Clarence Ashley, an old-timey singer who recorded in the 20s. The Kirkwoods probably heard it visiting their grandmother in North Carolina, where Watson and Ashley are from. Touring, the band took an instant dislike to hardcore audiences, and by the time Meat Puppets 2 appeared in 1983, they had radically rethought their music. Country music was an obvious influence by now in songs like Lost, but they had other tricks up their sleeves, which a young songwriter named Kurt Cobain heard while searching for a new approach for his band. Years later, he would invite the Kirkwoods to perform Lake of Fire on the MTV Nirvana Unplugged show. Audiences responded, too, as the band crisscrossed the country, and the band continued to revise its sound, with the next reference point being the Grateful Dead. Up on the Sun, the title track from their third release, shows it pretty well. The band was taking itself seriously. By now, Kurt Kirkwood was the father of twin daughters, and the critical response to their albums and tours was heartening. What wasn't so heartening was that they were on an indie label famous for hardcore, SST, which meant no money for promotion or tour support, limited distribution, and being lumped in with bands for which they felt no affinity. Their vision was expanding, with a distinct pop sensibility creeping in on their next album, Mirage. Discouraging, and they vowed they wouldn't spend too much time recording their next release. They didn't. Huevos was recorded and mixed in 3 days, but it doesn't sound that way.
Give me the mountains, give me the sea. Visions fill my head.
Now, the influence was synthesized into a recognizable Meat Puppets sound. Sexy Music sounds like nothing which preceded it, nor does the rest of the album. A strategy was devised in 1988. The band would make an album that would show they were ready for a major label. Monsters shows them walking a fine line, incorporating a sort of ZZ Top boogie and electric drums, but not giving up the patented Meat Puppets sound. It worked. In 1990, they were signed by London Records and put out three albums there, culminating in Too High to Die, which went gold. The follow-up, No Joke, didn't do as well. For one thing, the band wasn't playing live as much because Chris Kirkwood had fallen victim to severe drug problems, which his friends are now publicizing in an effort to help him. Kurt, meanwhile, has moved to Austin and is fronting a new Meat Puppets. While we wait to see what happens next, it's great to have the band's history so well documented on this set of CDs, a fitting tribute to a great American original.
Ed Ward is a writer based in Germany. Our thanks to Raul Hernandez of the Austin Chronicle for his research help. Coming up, we remember actress Madeline Kahn. This is Fresh Air. Actress Madeline Kahn died Friday of ovarian cancer. She was 57. Let's listen back to one of her great comedic performances. This is a scene from the Mel Brooks film Young Frankenstein, in which she played the fiancé of Dr. Frankenstein. Here she is with Dr. Frankenstein, played by Gene Wilder, and then with the monster himself, played by Peter Boyle.
Would you want me like this now? So soon before our wedding, so near we can almost touch it.
Yes!
Whoa! Oh, boy! Or to wait just a little while longer when I can give myself to you without hesitation, when I can be totally and unashamedly and legally yours.
That's a tough choice.
You're a tough guy. Now give me a kiss and say goodnight. No tongues. Good night, darling.
Mm-hmm.
Good night, sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
I love you.
Mm-hmm.
You love me?
Mm-hmm.
I love you, honey. Sweet dreams, darling.
Sweet dreams.
Good night, and let the bed bugs bite. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching, and glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Ah! Who are you? What? What are you? What do you want? What are you going to do to me?
Calm down. I'm not afraid of you. How much do you want to let me go? My father is very rich. You can have the entire world at your fingertips. Listen, I have to be back by 11:30. I'm expecting a very important call. Speak! Speak! Why don't you speak?
What are you doing? Oh, you can't be serious. I'm a... I,
my God. Woof. I'm engaged, and once he took, but I didn't. It was never enough time. All the, sweet mystery of life, at last I found you.
A scene from Young Frankenstein. Madeline Kahn died Friday at the age of 57. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Madeline Kahn from the soundtrack of the Mel Brooks film Blazing Saddles.
Time, sick and tired of love. I've had my fill of love from below and above. Tired of being admired, tired of love uninspired. Let's face it, I'm tired. I've been with thousands of men again and again. They promise the moon. They're always coming and going and coming. And always too soon. White girls, I'm tired. Tired of playing the game.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Saab, designing cars with the philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the dilemmas of home health care in the age of managed care. We talk with Kara Levine. She's the director of the United Hospital Fund's Families and Healthcare Project, and she cares for her husband, who was left paralyzed with brain damage after a car crash 10 years ago. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.